Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. Steve Williamson here, sitting across from me.
Mike Cosentino. Good morning. Good morning.
And we're really pleased to have Juan Cull.
I didn't know I'd become an all-star.
How are we doing, Tom? All right. We have Juan Cull on the line. He's actually working in the Library of Congress now, so he's called in. And he's a professor of history at the University of Michigan. He's a commentator, kind of, I think the term they use is public intellectual on the Middle East, on South Asia. He's written a blog since 2002 called Informed Comment. I followed it since then. He's written a half dozen books. He speaks all the languages that we don't, like Arabic and Persian and Urdu and Turkish and French, German, and Spanish. I studied French, German, and Spanish and never learned any of them. So welcome to the show, Professor.
Thank you.
You've written for so many different places, for the Washington Post, for the Guardian, for the San Jose Mercury News, San Francisco Chronicle, and a lot of other sources. And you've been on a lot of television shows and so forth and so on. I guess what I wanted to ask you, the civil war in Syria has been going on, I think, since 2011. And thousands and thousands of people have been killed. The country is just, if you see the photographs, you go on YouTube, Mike, you see the destruction in Syria. It's just awful to see. And there are dozens and dozens of groups all fighting each other, and particularly our chief enemy, which is ISIL or ISIS. And I guess what my question is, this is 2016. What do Americans need to know about the Syrian civil war now? I guess what can we do, or what should we do, or what do we do wrong? But what do we need to know now about the Syrian civil war and how it affects us? It's obviously causing incredible impact in Europe.
Well, the single best thing the U.S. has done in Syria was the negotiation with Russia last February for a cessation of hostilities or a ceasefire, which worked out for a few months much better than anybody had imagined it could. And getting back to that, because it's now fallen apart, seems to me the best thing the U.S. could do.
Do you think one reason that the Obama administration never really attacked the Assad government, the government of Syria, was that they knew that might provoke a Russian intervention in the country? It's a site of a Russian military base. It's Russia's only ally in the Middle East. Do you think that they had that in mind? Because there's been tremendous pressure for American interventions, for attacks on the Assad government, for no-fly zones, for arming different groups. And
well, I think the Obama administration was pressured very heavily by especially the Saudis to go in and help overthrow the government of Syria, the government that's led by Bashar al-Assad. But I think what happened in Libya gave Obama pause because they had done that in Libya. And then in the aftermath, especially from 2013 forward, Libya fell into very substantial disarray and still is a basket case. So you have to think about whether you want Syria to be a basket case. And as bad as it is now, and as much destruction and loss of life as have occurred, it is possible for things to get worse. and for things to stay worse for a very long time, probably about 70% of Syrians live under the Syrian government, and many of them in relative security, so that could all go away. And so I think Obama just didn't want to risk, truly further massive disruptions in Syria. And then from the rise of ISIL, when it took over northern and western Iraq in 2014, it became clear that, Obama needed allies in the region against ISIL, and who was stepping up, who was willing to step up, was not Turkey or the Saudis, all of whom had other axes to grind. It was the Shiite government of Baghdad and its Shiite allies in Iran. And Iran is allied with the Bashar al-Assad government in Syria. And so I think from that point forward, it became undesirable for Obama to attack the Syrian government, because it would risk ruining his de facto alliance with Iran on the ground in Iraq.
That's it. I mean, you have to admire Obama for not wanting to be Saudi Arabia's bitch in this. As Syria has these rebel groups that Steve referred to, and you have these surrogate battles going on. I mean, for some of us of a certain age, this is Vietnam all over again, that you got the Saudis encouraging the U.S. to attack, and Iran is saying, no, we kind of like what's going on. You did a column, an informed comment months ago about winners and losers. And I think that, if nothing else, it's a way to help us understand the Syria thing. I like it was fascinating what you said about that, life in Syria under some government still goes on. I mean, there's 70% or a certain number of the population that's still under the Syrian government's rule, and things are happening. But what I want to talk about are the winners and losers, because we don't see it. Saudi loses when America doesn't go in, but Iran wins. And then how about other countries in the region? Who's winning, who's losing?
Right. So Syria is a really central country, in that part of the Middle East. It borders, Israel. It borders, Lebanon, Turkey, Iraq, and it does, important to Saudi Arabia, which is one of the wealthiest countries in the world from its oil. So when it began to fall apart into civil war, all of these outside actors began supporting one faction or another there. Basically, the government of Syria had been Stalinism-lite. It was a one-party state. It said it was socialist. Arrests people for criticizing the government. It engages in torture. It's like East Germany used to be. It's an old Soviet-style a one-party state.
How does Russia play out in all this? Is Russia a winner or a loser with what's going on in Syria?
Right. Well, Russia decided that it wouldn't allow that al-Assad government to fall. And so they went in, especially with their air force. They gave air cover to the government since last fall. And while you can't ever predict what's going to happen in the future, so far, Russia is a winner. It has shored up the al-Assad government quite substantially.
So at this moment, Russia is a winner. I see.
Russia is definitely a winner. It's gained in prestige. It's made the point that it's a player in the Middle East.
Right.
And it has kept its client from falling.
And how about the American ally, Turkey, that, like you said, has shares a border and whatnot?
Turkey is a loser.
Turkey's a loser.
Turkey decided that it wanted to see al-Assad overthrown. It hadn't always had bad relations with al-Assad, but after he, al-Assad is guilty of war crimes. He crushed the Sunni Arab resistance,
right.
Killed thousands and thousands of people. So Turkey declared against him, so he has to go.
Let me throw you a curve here. A lot of us are happy, obviously, that Obama didn't go in. There's not Americans coming home in body bags and whatnot, which would have been, which we were tired of in Iraq and Afghanistan. Given that the governments and who's supporting who over there, do you foresee a day where there's no Syria, where they just... its position is unique, and as you already mentioned, and history over there is so convoluted, and we only hear the news and the history that supports American positions. So, do you foresee a day where there will be no Syria?
No, in the post-World War II period, there were a lot of questions raised about these lines that had been drawn in the sand in Africa and Middle East. A lot of these are colonial boundaries, whether they could survive in the post-colonial period. But actually, there have been very few adjustments of them, and some of those haven't been very successful, as with the secession of southern Sudan. Nations have a lot of weight, and there's reasons for which, there are internal markets, and there are reasons for which people cling together. They do fall apart. There are civil wars, but, I lived in the early years of the civil war in Lebanon in the 70s, and people kept wondering if Lebanon would break apart and become cantons. And it's fragile, but it all came back together. And I think Syria also will eventually come back together. The question is, under whom? Who's going to emerge on top?
A lot of the, when the U.S. Tried to negotiate with the al-Assad government, one of the sort of preconditions was that Assad agreed to leave power. And I think in the early days of the, when the civil protest broke out in 2011, Syria was doing a lot of things to try to ameliorate the situation, but what it wasn't willing to do was give up any power. Folks need to know that Syria is divided by religion between Sunni and Shiite and Druze and Christian and breakoffs of from the Shiite religion. And that the minorities have always tended to support the Assad government, which is, protects them from the Sunnis. And so when you had a civil conflict, demonstrations and stuff broke out, the country then evolved, I guess, into a sectarian battleground. And then, as Professor Cole was saying, every country in the world seems to have grabbed one group or another and given them arms and money and support. So how do you untangle this, or can we untangle this, Professor?
Well, the best thing that could have happened, and it didn't happen, I don't know if it ever will, would be if Syria could move to a kind of government based on elections. Because all of those groups that you were talking about, the sectarian ones and others, they'd end up with a representative in the parliament, and then it would be like our Congress. They could trade horses and make compromises. And that's what the young people in 2011 who revolted against the regime wanted. They wanted to move to free and fair parliamentary elections. And this regime, is a one-party state, and it just can't deal with having competitors or criticism or that kind of thing. And so they decided to draw up tanks and shell the protesters who were initially peaceful. And they turned it into a civil war because people felt if they're going to be attacked by their own government that they'll pick up a gun.
So people wanted a little self-government.
The end good result would be if all those groups could have members of parliament representing their interests and then work out compromises for the country. But whether that will happen in any immediate time frame is a real question.
I guess when the Assad government wouldn't really compromise with having power and having an election, the civil really, war is really on them. They refuse to compromise. They refuse to have elections. They refuse to share power, and civil protests quickly led to military conflict.
That's right. And, you know, it didn't have to be this way. I actually think that if the Assad government had, you know, what Tunisia did and gone to elections, that the country's elite might have done fairly well out of them. We don't know. But now they've made themselves into criminals and they've turned up the country. And it's going to be a long time before Syria gets peaceful again, and can we construct?
Do we want to shift and talk a little bit about what do you think, Mike? Talk about what's happening in Turkey, and Turkey is an old ally of the U.S. and it seems to be going bad. It seems to be getting more authoritarian, more sectarianly religious. It's restarted its war with the Kurds. And we can talk about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, where we have the same kind of Israel leadership going worse, getting worse and worse and worse. And what do you do when allies start going bad?
Yeah. Well, President Tayyip Erdogan of Turkey, you know, came to power, and his party came to power initially in 2002 through elections. And they, you know, religious right. They you know, favored people's religious liberties, but they didn't want to impose Muslim law or Sharia on people, and they haven't. But they said they believed in pluralism, and they arose in an environment where, you know, the official politics of Turkey was secular, and it was, you know, secular humanism, but at the point of a gun, you had to be secular, and the army was behind it. So over time, Erdogan has kept winning elections and become more and more powerful, and he's moved secularists out. But now he's, you know, bullying the press and jailing journalists, and he's moved from being a pluralist to being an authoritarian. And when he didn't get his way in the last elections last summer, his party only got 42% of the seats. A lot of people think he started up this conflict with the Kurds in order to become a war president and make people rally around him. So I think that a bare parliamentary majority in the second round of elections.
And it sort of worked. If that's what he did, it was a clever move in the worst sense, and that it sort of worked. Also, Turkey's been accused of basically coddling and supporting and protecting extremists, Islamic extremists, and being a haven for them, only to have, you know, ISIL turn on Turkey. Once they begin to crack down on them at all.
I want to ask a common man question here. How easy is it? Would we read about refugees, and we have arguments here, especially in places like Arizona. The government has arguments about refugees. And of course, then there's a Donald Trump. But how realistic is it for a Syrian to move into Damascus and find a relative peace and be able to live and at least not worry about bombs falling from the sky or death squads? Is that a reality rather than becoming a refugee, rather than trying to go into Western, into Europe?
Oh, well, there have, you know, the population of Syria before the war was about 22 million. Half of them are now homeless. Of the 11 million who no longer live in their homes, about 4 million were forced abroad, mainly to neighboring countries, Lebanon, Jordan, and Turkey.
Right.
And then the rest are internal refugees. So they have clustered into places, as you say, like Damascus, So there have been a lot of people who've moved from the government area out to be with the rebels, or vice versa, depending on who they are. You know, if you're an old Muslim Brotherhood activist, you're on the religious right, you're Sunni, and you go to Damascus, that's dominated by the Ba'athi government. It's socialist. A lot of the high officials are Alawite Shiites. That might not be very comfortable. So whether you can do that or not depends a little bit on who you are.
Sure, sure. Whether you're on the Muslim Brotherhood's hit list or whatever. Well, that's interesting. The events and going back to winners and losers, I guess. And we don't hear anything about the Free Syrian Army anymore. So we're going to say the U.S. government was a loser in this, I guess. They were never able to get enough impetus together, enough groups together to find anybody that wanted to work with them and get that Free Syrian Army. So that, as far as a surrogate war, America has been terrible in Syria. We haven't been able to get it together.
Well, the Free Syrian Army was originally associated with those groups that wanted democracy in Syria. But what they say, I'm just telling you their narrative, is that they couldn't get any funding to pay their fighters. So over time, where could you get money if you were opposing al-Assad was from Saudi Arabia and the Gulf and maybe Turkey. And that money tended to go to the people, you know, who were more fundamentalist in orientation. So, you go back to 2012, you've got people quoting Voltaire and Rousseau and talking about democracy, and gradually, you know, they start having beards and spouting a lot of fundamentalism because that's where the money was. So, you know, Hillary Clinton would say that if the U.S. had given money to the Free Syrian Army early on, that transformation of them into fundamentalists might have been forestalled. But as as things now stand, the major groups opposing al-Assad are mainly Muslim Brotherhood on the one hand, or radicals like al-Qaeda and ISIL on the other. And the U.S. has about 30 groups that it says are vetted as not al-Qaeda, that it still is passing money and arms to through the Saudis. The CIA is doing this. But those 30 groups, some of them show up on the battlefield as de facto allies of al-Qaeda. So at this point, the U.S. Is, you know, playing, I think, a pretty hypocritical game.
I remember reading one of the, American prisoners or British prisoners in Syria. And for him, his experience, there was no difference really between the al-Qaeda people that held him captive and the non-al-Qaeda groups that they passed him on to. It was all one sort of continuous spectrum. So if the extremist groups, and usually I think when you have a war, the liberal part of the society loses. If you have a civil war, that part of the society loses, and the guys who go to the guns are the guys who tend to dominate. And that's what we've seen happen in Syria, right? Is it's gone from a civil conflict where people are protesting to a military conflict. And then the people who are the most intense or have the most money are the people then who become strongest. And unfortunately in Syria, I know that the French, I think you had an article, are very concerned that it's not just, ISIL that's attacking France, but also the al-Qaeda-based groups.
Yeah, I think this is a big gap in American press coverage of Syria, which is that there are two big fronts. There's a northeast front and there's a northwest front. And the northeast front has had a lot of attention because that's ISIL. And in fact, there are 200 U.S. troops on the ground in northern Syria among the Kurds fighting ISIL or advising the Kurds on fighting ISIL. And so that's what we focused on. But in the north, west of the country, Al-Qaeda has and its allies have taken over the province of Idlib, and they were trying to take over the major northern city of Aleppo and the port city of Latakia, which is near that Russian base that you were talking about. So the Al-Qaeda in Syria is now the largest group of fighters in the world who are loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri, who was one of the masterminds of the 9/11 attacks. And I'm disturbed by U.S. government policy in that I don't see them as very concerned about Al-Qaeda and basically giving arms and money to de facto allies of Al-Qaeda. All of our attention has been on ISIL. And I, to tell you the truth, I couldn't tell you why that should be. I know that there's a split between the CIA and the Pentagon, as the Pentagon doesn't like this policy, and they say they don't see any allies of the U.S. in Syria. And the CIA seems to be supporting, you know, what they call the moderate fundamentalists.
Well, yeah, that ISIS, the Pentagon, CIA, we always forget we have our own issues to deal with, and it keeps any kind of organized front from going forward. Part of what I'm seeing, I'm going to put another note in here that the Kurds were another winner, I guess, at least at the moment. They got the American help and I guess going to say funding. The CIA and Pentagon couldn't agree on much, but they at least they could agree long enough to get Kurds some troops and some money to, so I think they end up winners in this, at least at the moment.
Yes, about 10% of Syrians are not Arabs. They're Kurds. They speak an Indo-European language related to English. They're Sunni Muslims for the most part, although there are some sectarian groups like Yazidis amongst them. But they have become anarchist socialists. Their ideology, if you read Noam Chomsky, they would pretty much agree with everything he says. So they're a very unusual group in the Middle East, and they have an emphasis on women's rights and feminism. They have women fighters. And as you say, they have pushed ISIL out of their areas, in part with U.S. help. I think they're mainly a Pentagon ally.
They're the most successful fighters on the ground against ISIL, are these groups, right?
That's right.
And Turkey is their bitter enemy.
Well, that's the problem. We got our allies, our enemies. You know, I mean, the Kurds and Turkey are our enemies.
So what do you think of these groups? I mean, part of their allies or associated groups are on terrorist lists from the long, gosh, is it 20-year battle of Kurds for some kind of an independent area in Turkey or protection for their language and so forth and so on. What do you think of these groups? These are actually the most effective fighters against ISIL, and yet they're this sort of anomaly.
Right. Well, they have some kind of a loose affiliation with the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers' Party, which did wage a dirty war, and of course we received from the Turkish army the other half of the dirty war in eastern Anatolia and Turkey in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. However, the U.S. position is that the YPG or the leftist Kurds are not terrorists, their main activity has not been in Turkey or of a terrorist character. It's been trying to establish some semi-autonomy against the al-Assad government in Syria. And as you say, they turned out to be the only people really on the ground who were able and willing to fight ISIL effectively. So we've got this situation where the U.S. Pentagon is deeply in bed with leftist feminist Kurds, and the CIA is supporting the Sunni Arab fundamentalists. And there have been some occasions in which the two U.S. allies, the two different agencies, have come into conflict in the north.
Well, yeah, one of the I just want to remind folks, we're talking to Juan Cole, internet commentator, informed comment, and history professor at the University of Michigan, and there's a lot going on. A lot of Americans are finally, especially young Americans, are waking up to find out the history that we learned and we get is filtered by our government that supports its policies, so very often, however, with things like the World Wide Web, there's some real information coming out. And one of the things I want to talk about is we don't hear, Juan, from Aleppo. We don't hear from Damascus. We don't have reporters, and I'm talking about journalists now. They report from Beirut, they report from places outside, or from Ankara. They're in Turkey. I mean, so there is almost, and I like to believe, I know journalists well enough that if they could be, they would be where the action is. Or is it just that we don't care? That there is no story there. Nobody wants to hear about, Syria anymore unless a refugee is moving into your neighborhood.
Oh no, the journalists, some young journalists have snuck in and they're eager to be there. And I think the editors would like to have those stories, but, the fact is that ISIL, kidnaps those journalists and beheads them or holds them for ransom and beheads them if it doesn't get the ransom. And in fact, I had a friend who is a veteran journalist who was reporting from, not Ankara, but from southern Turkey, Gaziantep, where there's a lot of Syrian refugees,
right.
And she had to leave because the word came out that ISIL had run out of Western hostages, and that therefore they were paying people to kidnap any Westerner they could find. And so she suddenly became in danger, even on the Turkish side of the border.
Wow.
And then Declan Walsh actually did get into East Aleppo, which is under government control, where about 2 million people live, and which is relatively safe, and life goes on there. Into West Aleppo, but in East Aleppo, which is about 200,000 people, is very slummy and under the control of the fundamentalists. No Westerner could go in there. And now it has the Syrian Arab Army and the Russians have cut it off. It's now completely cut off from outside contact.
Wow.
And I think the regime hopes to strangle it. So it's a really rough area for a journalist to try to operate in. It's now come out that Marie Colvin, who some of us remember was on the ground in Homs when the regime was bombing the bejesus out of it. The Al-Assad regime seems to have figured out where she was and where her satellite signal was coming from, and deliberately subjected her position to artillery fire to get rid of her. They didn't want the word coming out of what they were doing.
Well, they killed her, right?
It's tough.
They've killed her. How good is the reporting? For instance, we get a lot of secondary reporting out of Syria. How accurate do you think it is? Like, I've forgotten the name, the Syrian Observatory of Human Rights or what. So much of the time, that's who's quoted. Do you think they're giving us accurate reports? Do we have an actual picture? I mean, I know the, CIA and Pentagon have all their sources, but I'm talking about the American people knowing enough about what's going on to support it one way or the other.
Well, I think if you're interested in the subject of what's going on in Syria, the only thing you can do is to triangulate. You have to read several different sources. There's no neutral reporting. Everybody has a side. So I think among Western outlets, The Guardian does a good job. But I think a lot of the other organs, have an axe to grind of one thing of one kind or another. But I'll read, a lot of Al-Arabiya, which is the Gulf and Saudi influenced, and obviously hates Al-Assad or Al Jazeera likewise. On the one hand, but if you read like Russia Today, that's pro-Assad. You know, if you put it all together, I think you can get a picture, but you have to be discriminating.
Let's go back to the question I wanted to ask. Sorry, Mike, I stepped on you. And that's just, at this point, what should the United States do? What ideally, I mean, if you were able to control American policy in Syria and Turkey and Iraq, what would you have the U.S. do? What would be the, given the terrible conditions all around?
Yeah, well, it's a tough road to hoe. I think John Kerry's done an excellent job of trying to arrange for a ceasefire and trying to arrange for one that would last. And I think they had some real success with calming things down for the most part in the spring. But, you know, the problem is that the regime and the Russians have taken advantage of the ceasefire now to surround and besiege East Aleppo, where the rebels are. And so that's going to cause the whole thing to break down. And then the other problem was that ISIL and al-Qaeda were never part of the ceasefire agreement, and they are some of the major fighting forces on the ground. But if I were in John Kerry's shoes, I'd do what he's doing, which is to try to pressure the Russian, the Al-Assad regime to go back to the cessation of hostilities and to try to turn this war into a political process, because, you know, Clausewitz said that the war is politics by other means. Well, the politics by other means is much preferable to the war. And so if we could convince people who are right now rebels that they could lay down their arms and not be killed and could, you know, be
is
elected,
that possible?
Could elect to parliament a representative who would effectively bring their interests to Damascus, then, you know, ultimately you might be able to make some progress.
Is that possible? Is that sort of scenario where if you quit fighting, you can go back to keeping your shop and the Assad regime won't haul you off and you know?
Well, we saw some of that in March and April and May. So, it's not just a theoretical possibility. It can be done. But that process, as I said, is now broken down for the most part. The regime seems to think that they can use the Russian air power to reestablish complete control over the country, and that just strikes me as completely pie in the sky, and moreover as guaranteeing that the civil war will go on.
It seems an insane point of view. It seems like absolutely nuts to be able to put it together that way. So Assad controls. The regime controls the whole country. It seems preposterously beyond their reach.
Well, for me,
yeah,
it seems
they can't even control some neighborhoods of the capital, Damascus. So, as long as they have that delusion that they can win absolutely, that I think that the real danger of this thing going on. And I mean, you know, the Russians have remonstrated with them that to stop saying stuff like that. And it also is harmful to any kind of peace process, because if the other side thinks that they're going for complete annihilation of the opposition, then obviously there's no point in trying to make peace.
Well, you have to think that the American representatives are at some their elbows saying, keeping it going, keeping the delusion, as you called it, going, and rather than suing for peace, it doesn't take a military strategist to say Russian air power, Assad's extreme ruthlessness, let's give this up and try it another day. We'll organize under a different political, because war isn't exactly working. I want to I got to get my dig in here. The name of the show is Democratic Perspective. We're talking to Juan Cole. Because the name of the show is Democratic Perspective, Donald Trump gets worldwide coverage on his bigotry and racism. I've got to believe that he's become, is he a recruiting tool for the extremist groups in places like Syria and the Middle East.
Oh, sure. I mean, that's been proven.
Oh, of course.
he's been used. He's been deployed in their videos. And it goes beyond that. I mean, you have to think about the struggle with the extremists in the Middle East as partly a propaganda struggle, a struggle for hearts and minds. We want people in the Middle East to think well of us. And there are many reasons for which they ought to think well of us. The U.S. has, you know, in some countries has effectively ended malaria. It's contributed to better health care. It's helped, you know, we've had a big economic impact on helping people's prosperity. So that word doesn't get out very easily. But the fact is, there's a strong basis for people to think well of the United States in the region. And if we can get them to think well of us in the region, then a group like ISIL, you know, gets the plug pulled on it. It can't get recruits, and its message falls on deaf ears. So when you have a major American politician who, you know, is in the running to be president saying things so negative about the culture and religion of the people of the Middle East, then when ISIL comes along and says, well, the Americans are out to get you, we have to take up arms against them,
right,
that becomes more plausible.
Right, much easier to believe. Yeah, that's the this is the you know, the horror of his presence in American politics is it's like the gift that just keeps on giving. I want to make a quick announcement here. We have one of our supporters, Dore, Democrats of the Red Rocks, has a breakfast on the 21st of July coming up pretty quick at 8 a.m. at Old Sedona establishment. It's going to be a good talk on a living wage. Tomas Robles will be talking about a living wage on the 21st of July right here in Sedona at the restaurant. And we opened our, the Dore has opened its political office, at, 2855 West 89A here in West Sedona. And the third Sunday of the month, we get around and talk politics. So, when you show up this, Sunday, or the next third Sunday, I guess, we can talk about Juan Cole in the Middle East because you just listened to this show. And you'll have gone to Informed Comment, a column he has on the web, and you'll find out more about the Middle East. I like to think one of the reasons we like to do shows like this is we don't want the Middle East to become a complete confusion and something that we don't want to talk about.
We also need, you know, independent scholars and thinkers like Juan Cole out there and like Informed Comment and on the Internet, because it's been a center for people who don't work for any government,
right,
or who don't have an axe or a point of view of some foreign country to talk about issues and stuff.
Right.
It's a vibrant thing. It's been – when did you found it? Well, Juan, was it in 2004, 2002?
It was 2002 that I founded Informed Comment as a weblog. It was because of 9/11 and the aftermath, and it was to try to explain the struggle with Al Qaeda to the American people. At the time, you know, there wasn't much serious blogging.
Right. I do want to mention we have less than a minute left. And so we want to remind you to go to Democratic Perspective. Our website, vbid.org, will have this podcast in a few days, as well as all our podcasts. You can listen to all our old shows on vbid.org, or you can go to Informed Comment, or this Google Informed Comment, or Google Juan Cole, and you'll find all sorts of great information about the Middle East and things.
And we want to thank Professor Cole for being with us today.
You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.